So welcome along to this class, and those of you online, I'm glad to know that you're there. So as you can see, we're starting a new module today called How to Develop Bodhicitta. If you haven't heard of the term bodhicitta, it's a Sanskrit word which means mind of enlightenment. And it often goes along with this mind is called like a wish to attain perfect enlightenment for the benefit of beings. Now, the way we normally begin this class, of course, and the way we'll do today, is we'll take refuge together, we'll generate the mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, and then we'll say a few prayers and actually engage in the class. And during the class, there are moments for questioning and also for meditation. So, let's begin. So it's important that you all are comfortable in your seat. So this comfort entails that you sit with a straight back. So your spine should be elongated, your shoulders drop down, relaxed. Place your hands wherever you like. And if you want to, you can close your eyes completely, leave them partially open or fully open, whatever suits you. So when you are comfortable in your seat, just allow the body to breathe itself. And while the body breathes itself, allow yourself to relax completely. And then direct your mind inwardly and acknowledge how you feel as you breathe. And while you're breathing normally and naturally, imagine in the space above you appears Shakyamuni Buddha. Was golden in color. And he is sitting on a large golden throne. Now, surrounding him are many other fully enlightened beings. There are bodhisattvas, there are the arahats, the solitary realizers, and deities, and many others. These are all the space in front of you and slightly above your eyebrows. Meanwhile, surrounding you are all sentient beings. These include your parents, family members, friends, difficult people, and strangers. And these are all these people, including yourself, are looking towards the Buddha and his spiritual entourage. You recollect that everyone has an equal wish, or they equally wish to avoid suffering. They equally wish to be happy. And they equally lack genuine happiness. Now, because you know that the causes of suffering can be eliminated, and that the potential for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us, we've taken this responsibility to lead all sentient beings who surround you in the safe direction of the Buddha, his teachings, and his community. Through freeing yourself from suffering and its causes, all the natural good qualities spring forth. There's good compassion, there's good compassionate qualities of kindness, seeking to protect others, faith, and joy. So wishing to develop all good qualities and to put an end to all difficult, hindering qualities. We rely upon the methods and the wisdom taught by the Buddha and his community. So let's now take our refuge in those, the Buddha and his community, who have abandoned the causes of suffering and have all good qualities fully flourishing. Again, think that you're doing this not just for yourself, but for everybody. So to affirm this, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this prayer of ours, think that lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. And these lights and nectars that pour down upon you and those surrounding you remove all obstacles to happiness. And they empower the present potential you have to develop the methods and the wisdom. This being the case, you now recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And you decide to establish all the people surrounding you into those four immeasurable states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of ours, again, from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream down. They remove every obstacle and hindrance to your development of these four boundless thoughts. And these four qualities of boundless love, compassion, joy, and equanimity now effortlessly manifest. And following their manifestation, you now recollect the field of merit, which is the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and you prepare yourself to purify your mind, to accumulate merit and to increase the merit. So with the Buddha and his companions appearing as a field of merit, join me in saying, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So we've accumulated some merit and we've purified the mind somewhat. What we don't want to do at this moment is to cling to our actions as if they had any intrinsic nature. So to counteract clinging, recollect emptiness and dependent origination. And imagine your body is utterly transformed along with your virtues and your speech, everything that you hold dear. In fact, the whole universe itself is utterly transformed through your knowledge of dependent origination and emptiness to now reappear as a wonderful and pure land of the Buddhas. And I think if you want to offer this land to the Buddha himself. So you say, now this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamariataya. They've released the offering and the Buddha accepts it with delight and he smiles at us. And when he smiles at us, we look up into the eyes of the Buddha. And looking into his eyes, we feel accepted, at ease, and with a feeling of confidence that our wishes will be experienced. And now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and it moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. And now this emanation descends down to the level of your heart and it begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light and nectars, which pour out through the pores of your skin and begin to fill the 10 directions of space. Establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. So no difference, no separation. No self, no other. And in this vast absence, you hear the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha. And so you join in, just reciting it three times. Tayata Om Mimri Maharmanaya Tayata Om Mimri Maharmanaya Tayata Om Mimri Maharmanaya. And just recite it a few times under your breath and try to feel its resonation throughout the body. Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Now the lights withdraw from the 10 directions of space and re-enter your heart. You can feel yourself breathing and sitting on the seat. It's possible you can hear different sounds of traffic and so forth. Again, this means that you're embodied and present. And we recollect this meditation we've done has been one of imagination. And through this imaginative process, we've imprinted the mind with a potential for full awakening to benefit others. Now, to actualize full awakening and be of actual benefit for others, there are many other things we need to do. And one of them, of course, is to rely upon an authentic teacher who can impart the teachings of bodhicitta authentically. So make this wish that this takes place, that you develop an authentic mind that seeks enlightenment for the benefit of others. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth, and just let your eyes flutter open when you're ready. Okay, so again, I'll welcome everybody back to this DB module called How to Develop Bodhicitta. So, this course lasts for about 8 weeks. We're going to look at the mind of enlightenment called bodhicitta and the stages for its development and what is done after it's developed. So, we do this through these four sections. We'll talk about impartiality, then compassion, which are the sort of roots or the ground that the mind of enlightenment is cultivated upon. Then we have the mind of enlightenment itself. It's developed through a number of different methods. Finally, we look at the perfections in the vow and finish off with a meditation practice on bodhicitta. Okay, so I base this course on a lot of material. Probably the best material for us, or at least for the beginner, I think, would be this book down at the bottom here called In Praise of Great Compassion, and a book up above it called Steps on the Path. They're quite thick, but they're easily readable. They're not academic treatises or some scientific writing. You can read this material and understand it. However, if you think that's like, no, I think that's all I can say. They're the best. And then down here, we've got the bottom three books called The Awakening Mind, Bodhicitta, and Achieving Bodhicitta. These are very interesting too. What you find when you read all this material is, stuff one author will leave out and another will bring in. So I like to read quite widely, just to get a good overall understanding of what's going on. And we have all these books in our library and some of them in the bookshop. But today we're going to focus on what's called equanimity. So this is the foundation. Before you can have bodhicitta or the mind of enlightenment, we have to start somewhere, and that is what's called the development of equanimity. So our subject matter today is all about that. So look at three types of equanimity, meditative equanimity, and the differences in its development. And through doing this, we're going to basically answer five different questions. So I'll tell you what the questions are. We're going to find out what equanimity is, first of all, and the three types of equanimity. Then there's a difference between equanimity and indifference. They sort of feel the same. They're very, very similar, but they're not the same. And it's very easy to confuse them. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then how equanimity is developed differently in terms of how the mind of enlightenment can be developed. Because the mind of enlightenment can be developed in two ways, and three actually, but two mainly. You push them together and you've got a third. But this equanimity I want to talk about today is one for seven cause and effect meditation, and the other meditation called equalizing and exchanging self for others. Thank you. Yep. So let's look first of all at these three types of equanimity and why we start with that rather than what is equanimity straight away. So as you can see here, we have three types of equanimity, one called feeling, one called application, and one called immeasurable. So equanimity is not a single uniform mental event. There's, like I said, there are three types, three distinct categories, and each type serves a sort of a unique purpose on the path. So the equanimity of feeling, first of all, so this refers to the basic neutral sensation that we feel that is neither physically painful nor pleasurable. So everyone is familiar with this, right? As you go through many parts of the day where you go, if I asked you, how do you feel? You feel, you go, okay. That's usually equanimity of feeling. It's not like you feel really great, and it's not like you feel terrible. So it's somewhere between that there, and it's like, hard to say. It's in the middle somewhere. I can't say it's bad, I can't say it's good. There's just neutral feelings. So that's the first type of equanimity. The second is the equanimity of application. So this is a really highly advanced mental factor, which is cultivated during single-pointed concentration. So some of you might have heard of a practice called calm abiding or shamatha. It's a very deep state of meditation. This equanimity of application is within that practice. And it's, so it's experienced when the mind rests perfectly on its object. It allows you to stop making any effort. So, you know, so when you try to meditate, right, it takes effort to put your mind on the object. It takes effort to keep it there. Because what you'll find is you put it and it's gone, isn't it? So you've got to keep putting it back. And then when you keep putting it back, you've got to apply, you've got to hold it there, which requires mental strength. But once it's done perfectly, you leave it alone. This is the equanimity they're talking about. Once you've got everything settled, there's no sort of excitement in the mind and there's no sort of sinking feeling. You've got it. So once you get it, you leave the mind alone. And this is the equanimity of application in meditative practice, especially concentration. Is this okay so far, what I've said? Do you understand? So one is this feeling, and the other one is like when I place my mind on the object, and I can just rest it on it, just relax there. I don't need to work anymore. I've got it. It stays there. Okay. Yeah, okay. So Cal said, funny thing is once you've got it, you haven't got it. Okay, so I'll just say some. So when we say we've got it, there's a mental fact that should know you've got it. Right? That won't take you away from anywhere. But if you bring in, oh, I've got it or something like that, that will. So it's not a thought, it's a recognition. Oh, the mind is just stably there. And that's it. And it's saying that once it's there, don't do anything now. But it doesn't require anything. If you do any more, it chucks it out again. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's enough. Is that enough for you? Yeah, okay. Now we come to this next equanimity called immeasurable. So this is a sort of a social and altruistic attitude which has been cultivated to prepare the mind for universal love. Then from universal love to universal compassion, then the mind of enlightenment. So this type of mind removes the prejudices and the biases in the mind. So what do I mean by that? So just by me looking at all of you, right? So there's a couple of people here, first time I've basically seen them or recognized them. So my mind towards these people is basically sort of a neutral. But there's others here I've seen a number of different times, and they come here all the time and they're working, and I might have a bit more affection for them. But then Cal said something nasty to me last week, and I still remember. Right? So I don't like him. I remember what he did. So you can sort of see here, like to one person, I'm biased, dislike. Oh, these ones, I like them. Those other people, I don't know them. So this is what this meditation does, is take the bias away. You can still call people friends, enemies, and strangers, but you don't have the attachment to the friend. You don't have the hatred or animosity towards the person who said something unpleasant. And you don't have the indifference to strangers. So if we have indifference to strangers, if the mind retains that state or attachment to friends or aversion to the difficult people, there's no way we can develop the mind of enlightenment. It's impossible. Because the mind of enlightenment is directed to all beings. Right? And our hatred or our dislike or aversion is just a few, isn't it? I mean, it's not like I look out here and go, I hate you all, but I'll teach anyway. Or I really like you all. You know, it's not like that. So it removes prejudice by treating friends, enemies, and strangers with the exact same degree of deep human care. This is what we're trying to develop or cultivate, this type of mind. Yeah. It ensures that our kindness extends to every living being. That's the idea, because the mind of enlightenment is directed towards all living beings. And Buddha, enlightenment itself is for all living beings. And Buddhahood is achieved because your care is for all living beings. So we have to start, first of all, taking away these prejudices and biases. And that's what equanimity is to do. Equanimity also has another name. Sometimes it's called impartiality. But as long as you understand, the idea here is to remove the bias from the categories of friends, enemies, and strangers, and sort of try to get this even-minded attitude that you build all the positive qualities on. There's a quote that says from Jigme Lingpo, he's a terrific meditator, this fellow, and he said this. Now, for those online, of course, so impartiality is freedom from attachment and hostility, when sides and factions are all seen as equal, when enemy and friend and neither are all treated with even-handed kindness. We should practice these four attitudes, remembering that all is without true existence. So I particularly like, I put this one in because I really like this little bit at the end, that all is without true existence. But generally, you can see, get the general idea here, I hope, with the quote. So this equanimity is, like I said, cultivated before developing the great compassion, the great love, and then later on, the mind seeking enlightenment for all beings. Now, this line here saying that all is without true existence simply says that things do not exist in the way they appear to us. So if things appear to us, if things appear to us to be true and were true, then we'd say they were true. But if things appear to be true to us and they're not actually true, then something else is going. This is sort of what it's saying. And what it's saying is that, the people that you look at, that you have these ideas about, like, for instance, you're quite an aggressive guy, right? It appears true to me, but it's in fact not true. Because in fact, Carlos bought me lunch today. He's not a bad guy at all. Right? So it's sort of trying to say to you that these categories flip in and out all the time. Today, Cal's a nice guy to me. Next week, he's forgotten all about it. He doesn't even think he's like a stranger. A week after that, he's good or bad. Just like us, right? Sometimes you grow up, you really, like, for instance, have good relationships with your brothers or sisters. So we've got love and attachment there. Then one of them does something bad to us. Now we have aversion for them. We don't speak to them for years. Right? They drop away and then they become like strangers. Then they do something, they recognize, got to get in touch with Eddie again. They send me an email and a present, and now we're back together as friends. So it's just this idea that these categories continually shift. They're not true. This is this, without true existence. The categories don't have any true existence, because as you know, people go in between the categories, don't they? They never stay truly within their category. This is what it's trying for us to acknowledge, right? Now, this mind of impartiality or equanimity is not an easy thing to develop. And it has what they call enemies. And the enemies are called near enemies and far enemies. And the near enemy is something that really looks like the real thing, but in fact it's not. So in other words, we've got a mental state that is very similar to equanimity, but it's not. And if you think that other state is equanimity, well, you're wrong, and that's not what's an enemy. They're so close. And then the other, what's called a far enemy, that's like the enemy that's really easy to recognize. So the great, we'll put the slide up. So near and far enemies. So the near enemy is this indifference based on worldly life. Another way of saying it is apathy based on worldly life. And here's the one that really stands out for me, because I was doing this quite a lot. And then later on you realize that's not equanimity. You're not going to get equanimity like that. This is what I used to do a lot. Not noticing the faults or qualities of others. So, you know, you don't acknowledge them because you want to get, you know, because you think if I do, then the mind will go up or down. But in fact, it doesn't lead you to equanimity. Another one is just like, you know, this sort of just not caring. This is also very similar to the state of the state of it. It's the thing is that you do care. So these are mental states that we need to recognize so we don't mistake them for what we're trying to develop, equanimity. So what do you think would the far enemies be then? What would be a far enemy of a real enemy, like something you really recognize as being a problem for developing equanimity? Hatred, let's have a look. Yep. Anger and malice. Because if you're angry with somebody or have malice or hatred, your mind's not equally towards them. It doesn't seem to be just like me, like everybody else. Cruelty, jealousy, partiality, and of course prejudice. So none of these minds are even, are they? If you have a mind that's envious of somebody, what's the mind doing then? Yeah, comparing, contrasting, and developing. Look, a sense of dissatisfaction. These are really, you know, states you can't build anything solid on. You can't build a stable thing when the whole basis is unstable. So what is indifference? It's basically just having no particular interest, concern, or feeling towards something or someone. So these two, equanimity and indifference, they appear identical on the surface. Both states present a calm exterior that remains unshakable during external turmoil. However, you know, like a person could appear to be stable, but inside be seething. You know, we see that as people say, I'm cool. And what does that mean? It usually means I don't care. I'm indifferent to what you're doing. I don't care what you're doing. Right? So that's not equanimity. That's indifference. Yeah, so this... indifference operates through emotional withdrawal. When a person encounters a stranger or a difficult situation, the self-centered mind seeks to protect itself. It creates a barrier by choosing not to care about the welfare of others. This mental state is cold, disconnected, and passive. It ignores the reality of universal suffering, because it finds external problems inconvenient. So indifference reduces a person's capacity for empathy. And it sort of traps us in a small cocoon of self-absorption. So you'll always notice, if you just reflect on this, when you became indifferent to somebody else's suffering, So mostly for myself, at least I can speak about myself. When I'm in the company of others who are suffering, if they don't want to take my advice, I'm just prepared to walk away from them. See ya. All right, so I sort of become indifferent, but I don't have the patience to sit with them, right? Stay with them and be like calm, you know. Inside it's like, yep, they're suffering. They're just like me. There's no difference between us. They want to be happy just like me. It depends. If the person is open to advice and you can't give it to them while they're suffering, you need to wait quite a few minutes so they calm down again. They can't hear your advice as good words. They'll hear it as suffering. So to offer advice while somebody is suffering, not such a great idea. Right? You need to wait and calm, wait for them to calm down. Then you could offer something. Yeah, so and so I'll just answer that. I'll just be a rock, right? So there's a piece of advice in Way of the Bodhisattva. Right? So when somebody is right in front of your face, suffering, right, and you want to speak, because it's affecting you, right? You know, so oftentimes when people are suffering, we start suffering too. It's not that we stay real stable, or at least I don't. It's like I start getting worked up too, right? And I want to do something to help them. I want to stop their suffering and my own. So Shanti Deva says, become like a tree, which means shut your mouth. And when they start, whatever they're saying, bear it. Ask a tree if it hurts when you yell at it. And they go, that doesn't do anything, you're a tree. So you sit there like that, so become like what I think he calls a log. Be like a log. So their suffering doesn't affect the log. Right? So you wait there like that, you keep your mouth shut, the person finishes their rant, whatever they're doing, you wait a bit longer, then you might say something like, wow, you're going through a really difficult time, I can see that. Wow. You know, I went through something like that once, and this is what I don't know whether it will help you or not, but you know, if you want to listen to what I've got to say. So we have to be quite skillful in responding to other sufferings, that's for sure. Oftentimes, if we're not, we often exacerbate the situation. At least I do. You know, it just makes a bigger mess. So oftentimes in the beginning, it's better just to be quiet. Wait till the thing settles down. You've had a bit more time to think about what they've been saying, how they're suffering, and you can offer something that might help. Okay. So again, the differences here, just make it quite clear to you, hopefully. The equanimity means to be an unbiased mind without favoritism, and another term, equanimous. The other side is, like I said, you can see. Basically, it means I don't care. And many of us, as you know, are indifferent towards the suffering of others. This is taking place on a planetary level, isn't it? So now I open it up to, I've always put the slide in called What's Interesting. So this means, do you guys have any questions? If you, just like you did, Geraldine, you got something to ask or speak about, or you find interesting? Yeah, open to suggestions. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Okay, so say it again, please, Carl, I can reflect it. So in the seven habits of China, seven habits for what's for highly effective people. And what was the author? Do you remember? I remember this book. Stephen Covey, yeah. Seek first to understand and then to be understood. Oh, excellent. Thank you. Well, let's wait a bit at the end, see if I can add some more to it, and then you can sort of, you know, see if it works out all right. Okay, have you had anything else anybody would like to ask? Or there are problems with just experiencing the empathy and leaving it there, that's for sure. That, in fact, what it does is increases your own suffering and makes you really incapable of really helping the other. Because you start suffering just like the other. So now we've got two problems. Yeah. So empathy needs to be like say, the doorway to compassion. because compassion is a wish. I'll jump way ahead now. So there are two types of compassion, what we call ordinary compassion, and this is stated in the text as a wish. There's the other, we're not suffering. That's compassion. Yeah? But Mahayana compassion is not that. That's the basis of it. But the thing is, I will remove your suffering. I will protect you from suffering. So it's got this added bit. So, yep. I don't want you to suffer. This is compassion, right? May you be free of suffering. I don't want you to suffer. But we've got to do more than that. But just wishing ain't going to cut it, is it? So it's like the Mahayana is there. I need to do something to either remove the suffering you're experiencing by talking to you, helping you, or protecting you from it. Like this morning, I had a conversation with my partner, and I had to say to you, have you noticed that every time you get upset, how much your back and neck start to ache? Right? And I'll try to point out to you the relationship between the mind and the body. That if you start thinking negative stuff, then does, what happens with your body? Does it start feeling more pain? He goes, yeah. There you go. There's the connection. So be careful how you think, because it affects the whole system. No, that's right. That's exactly right. But yeah, again, it's highly dependent, isn't it? Yeah. On the person, the time, the place, all these sort of things. And just like Cal said, you need to really understand where they're coming from and then try to make be clear about, are you understood? Am I understood when I explain this to her? You know, so it took a couple of times, of course, because, you know, there's oftentimes you don't connect the two, but the way you think is having something on your body. It's really easy the other way, isn't it? Something happens to your body and now you get upset. Yeah, see the connection that way? But the connection is the other way too. Yeah, and I was going to say, one thing you could ask straight away is from the side of the other person, what makes any one of them more or less deserving of my care? Travis. We'll come to that, Travis. There's lots of different things you can say and do. But the first thing is for you to recognize yourself that you're not equanimous. Right? The mind is, your own mind is biased one way or the other. As soon as you recognize that, then you can apply a solution, which might be, what is actually the difference between myself and other? Now, ultimately, there's none whatsoever. And conventionally, you could say there's no difference in these terms. I suffer, you suffer, we're the same. We're equal. You suffer, you want to be free from your suffering, you don't like it, I'm the same. We are both under the control of many other different factors, and that's why we're suffering. We're the same again. So I've never read this through, but I thought of it the other day. I thought that this might help too, Travis, where, you know, when we look for the causes of our suffering, many of us will focus on people. We'll go, them. Yet in the Buddhist texts, nowhere in any Buddhist text that you will ever read will you find a person being the cause of someone else's suffering, ever. There's nothing in there like that. So you might figure out the same thing here, Travis. You go, look, just like, you know, just as I blame other people for my problems, so do they. There again, we're equal. You know, hopefully if you stay around, Travis, we'll find more and more little pieces of advice I could try to give you like this. And of course, if you don't find them suitable, send a message through to Demi, and during the week I'll have a look around, see if I can find you something that you can actually work with. So let's do a meditation, folks. Again, you just got to, you know, sit comfortably. Just check your shoulders. Drop your shoulders. Lengthen the spine. And just check that your head is sitting evenly on your neck. And when you're ready, I let your eyes sort of half close, so a little bit of light comes in, and let your body breathe itself. Now just feel the full weight of your body on the seat. And let your mind expand to sense everyone else in the room. And altruistically offer this meditation to all beings who mistake indifference for equanimity. And wish them sort of contentment and freedom. So I take a few moments now to just to recollect someone, anyone, that you are indifferent to. So we're mainly indifferent to strangers, and we know more strangers than anybody else. So this should not be too difficult. Recollect someone you are indifferent to. This is a person you could pass without a thought. But notice how the mind can develop a wall between yourself and other. This wall sort of confirms the strangeness of the stranger. It says to us, I don't know you. I don't need to care about you. You are a stranger to me. And what happens to us? What happens to the mind when we think like this? There's a sense of, like I said, indifference, non-caring, numbness. This all arises from fear. And this fear keeps us locked inside a small, closed sense of self. Therefore, let your indifference, the wall of indifference, let it fall. Recollect that the stranger will grow old, may get sick, and will, for certain, die. This is just like you. You too will grow older, you'll get sick, and you will die. And see if you can let your heart remain open to the pain of the stranger and of oneself. Just replace cold distance with warmth, with care. To appreciate the stranger as a fellow traveler in life. They deserve the same kindness that you give to yourself. They deserve the same protection. They're just like you. Try to stay alert to every person you meet and refuse to hide behind a numb and closed mind. Try to see the sameness in friends, enemies, and strangers, and oneself. Try to keep an open, balanced mind that does not favor one person over the other. And just let that sort of still and open mind, that mind of equanimity, be like the ground that all beings can rest upon. And now breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale. Let your eyes flutter open. Now, I was saying before that there are a number of different ways you can develop the mind of enlightenment. And so therefore it follows, because equanimity is this first basic step. In one way of meditating, it's a preliminary. In the other meditation, it's an actual step. So we're going to look at these two different ways of meditating and the two ways of approaching equanimity. Now, the founder of our tradition, called Lama Tsongkhapa, said this in his Lamrim Chenmo. He says, "From the outset, establish an even-minded attitude, eliminating the bias which comes from attachment to some living beings and hostility to others. Otherwise, any love or compassion you feel will be biased. You will never feel unbiased, affectionate love or compassion. So cultivate impartiality." So this is the type of equanimity which serves as the basis for the type of meditation called the Six Causes and One Effect meditation. So Six Causes and One Effect meditation leads you to the development of the mind of enlightenment, or bodhicitta, which this whole course is about. As the preliminary for that type of meditation, we need a type of equanimity. And this equanimity is the one of friend, enemy, stranger that we've basically been talking about. Oh, what happened there? Now, the other type of meditation, another type of equanimity, is developed in relationship to a meditation called equalizing, exchanging self for others. And in that meditation, the idea is to develop this feeling that there's no difference between myself and others. So can you notice the difference here? If not, I'll show it shortly. But basically, you're saying in the first one, friend, enemy, stranger, they cannot be categorized firmly in their categories, can they? Because a person changes from a stranger to a friend or an enemy, and then goes backwards and forwards. And so between them, you can see there's some sort of equanimity there, if you can remove the bias. This other one here is between me, your one self, and others. The other's between the three, friend, enemy, stranger. There's no difference between a friend, enemy, stranger. The categories shift all the time. This one is saying no difference between you and friend, enemy, stranger, anyone else. So here we go. The differences in equanimity are this impartial equanimity, the six causes and one effect. You generate a feeling of equal emotion towards others. You emotionally feel the same towards others. This one is that you have this idea that you know there's no difference between others. Now, to develop these, both methods start with the six causes and one effect. So first, in the seven cause and effect method, this works at the emotional level. And these two meditations are working at different layers of bias. But one is between friends and strangers, the other is between me and others. There's the differences. So seven cause and effect method works at the emotional level. The meditator removes attachment towards friends, aversion towards enemies, and indifference towards strangers. But the sense of I and others remains. Nevertheless, the emotional charge seems to clear up a bit. Because of this, love and compassion flow equally to all beings. But the second one, equalizing self with others, this method goes a bit deeper to the thought level, the conceptual level. Here we dismantle the belief that self and others are separate and unequal in worth. So I've done this. It's a really good sort of, what can I say, little play you can play with these things. So you know, if you put yourself in a room, so who's the most important person in the room if you're the only person in the room? I am, aren't I? Put somebody else on and ask it again. Who's the most important person? Yeah, that's right. Now, if you put in even, so put a whole lot of other people, 30 people in there, who's the most important person in the room? Yeah, it always comes back to me. Everyone feels this way. Everyone thinks this way. In this type of meditation, they say, yep, we've all got this. What makes the difference between them being more important than yourself is the word them. Is plural. There are more of them than yourself. That's why they are more important. Even though we all hold a singular belief that we are the most important person in the room. Yeah. So I used to play this game with myself, and I'd play the game where everybody's going to get executed in the room. Right? And they go, so who's going to go first? Not me. Right. Yeah, that's right. So this goes.
Anyone is more important.
No, that's right. And that's right. That's right. And in fact, that's how they test you. And I remember reading this guy being tested in the Pali tradition. They did this like this, gave all these choices. And the fellow said, I can't choose. And I think this was the one where the master said, somebody's going to come and kill a number of people. Who should be killed first? Who should be left alive? And he said, "Like I can't choose." And he said, "Okay, you've got it. That's the result. Right? You cannot choose. Everyone is of equal importance." So if you said myself, you'd be wrong. Right? If you took the other person, you'd be wrong. This is after, if you've got equanimity. If you choose one or the other, you're mistaken because you're equally valuable. So you can't do that thing. But like you said, Demi, in terms of equalizing the self with others, that's how they start off. And go, yeah, there's no difference there. What's the difference then? Got numbers. There's more of them than there is of me. That's the only reason others are more important. Well, I wouldn't use that reasoning to take my life. What did you say? So Yvette wanted to throw a qualm into the works, which means... Okay, so there's two people. Yvette was saying there's two people in the room, yourself and the person called Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And what one of you, yeah. Yeah, what? Guess what? Lama Zopa would say, no, it'll be me. Why not? But Lama Zopa's got the bodhisattva attitude. He would take the death, but you don't. This one with his compassion, he'd go me. Oh, well, I'd love to see you push that up against one of the teachers. Right? We, sentient beings, are the cause of Lama Zopa Rinpoche's realizations. So you want to take out the cause. So now he's got nobody to develop bodhicitta with.
Yeah.
Well, I'm one of them. And there's no difference between me and anybody else. We're equal. Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't work. There's no way the teacher would go, yeah, for me. But from our perspective, we'd probably go me because you're more valuable. But these are different ways of looking at it. That's not looking at it through friend, enemy, stranger, or this other one. You know, you're more asking more of those sort of questions don't really have much to do with this type of meditation, really. But like I said, there's two answers there. If you took it from Rinpoche's thing, I'm sure he'd go, me, of course, I'm prepared. I've got the realization of I understand emptiness and great compassion. I'll come back again, no problem. You as a sentient being will probably go straight to hell. Right? Well, he said, I would. So maybe I should stay here. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I don't know. It's all over. Yeah. I just wanted to say about a metaphor here, which I thought was really nice. So in terms of the slide here, so this, we've got two types of equanimity, impartial equanimity or immeasurable equanimity, and then this other type of equanimity. So immeasurable equanimity is the mind free from gross attachment and aversion. Whereas equalizing oneself with others is the mind that feels there is no such separation. So a mind that's free from gross attachment and aversion, the mind, we are not separate. No such separation. We're the same. So how are we the same? In that you have a wish to be happy and you have a wish to avoid suffering. In that we are the same, there's no difference. And the other one is a mind free from those gross states, meaning the states that we basically experience every day in our lives of aversion, indifference, attachment. So as a metaphor, this is two renovations taking place in the same building. So the same building here is, you know, we say us, we are like the building, and there's two types of work that could go on in the building. So the first type of work removes every lock from every door. So now all the doors are open. The second removes all the walls. There are no separate rooms left. So both are renovations. One tidies up the structure, the other transforms it completely. I liked it. That's why I stuck it in. I thought, oh, that's a good way of looking at it. Go into the house, my house, this room here. First thing I do, open up all the doors. Right? Everyone can come in there, knock down all the walls when they were all the same. So in the walls, of course, if the walls are all up and the doors are open, we've got friend, enemy, stranger. Knock them all down. No difference between us. Now we don't. I'm surprised at how quickly I went through all this. Do you guys have any more? Anything you'd like to ask about this? You can chuck in another qualm. Well, this is terrific, Cal. Okay, so this website for the audience, right? Can I give a great example here? He goes off to watch his son play rugby league, right? And like he wants his son to get that ball and score the try. And if not his son, well, another member of the team, but somebody on his side or our side, right? And he just can't. Yeah, I know. I was just thinking that's a great training ground right there, isn't it? So many years ago, there's a documentary of it where Bhutan got into the World Cup playing soccer. Anybody see this film? Oh, that wasn't a terrific game. So you know how the normal way that Cal goes, right? So when their team scores, it's like, yay, great. These guys go, oh. So they didn't go, oh, when they lost or anything. But they were really concerned about the loss that the other team would feel if they lost, if Bhutan won and the other team lost, how terrible it would be for that team. Yeah. So what they were doing, each time they scored a goal, either side, they'd recite the Heart Sutra. And the whole audience would recite the Heart Sutra. Oh, my God, man, that is on the ball. Right. Yeah, so they had this whole idea of both sides being really valuable. It's wonderful, of course, that Bhutan could play and so forth. But there wasn't this big thing of like, you know, and we must win and being dejected when we lost. That just wasn't there. But I think your example comes a very good one because this is a really simple way to show how these minds of bias arise, don't they?
It's a whole
That's right, mate. So this is terrific. So if you can notice this with yourself, you can say, oh, there's the attachment. There's the attachment. What can I say? I think it's called superimposition. So you impose. So we've got this term, like, and this is what happens. We've got Cal's young son, whom he loves, right? But then attachment creeps. So love is him wanting his son to be happy. But then the attachment comes in and goes, yeah, just my son. Just my son, score the goals. Right? So attachment's an extra bit. We want to keep the love, but we don't want the attachment. Just like, you know, we can notice difference, but we don't have to have aversion because there's difference between us. Yes, well, that won't work either, is it? Because they're meant to be equal. But, you know, like your children need food, and the poor who deserve food should need food too. So they should be equal. Yeah, but again, like you say, but sometimes when you practice unequally. Okay, so we've got a, what's the question? So first I'll ask you guys a question, right? So what's the major difference between the two types of equanimity? It's okay. Yeah. So this is how. So here I'm asking, what are the differences between the equanimity developed in the six causes of one effect, and in relationship to the other one in equalized exchange, Demi?
Anthea suggests.
Which one is that for?
Anthea.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay. And. Okay. So. So the first one is, the first one equalizes friend, enemy, stranger. The second one equalizes me and you, me and others. That's the difference. Right. Yep. Okay. So the major the differences here are, the first type of equanimity equalizes friend, enemy, and stranger. The second type of equanimity equalizes you and I, or me and others. That's it in a nutshell. Jeez, I hope you take that away. Right.
So,
yeah. Friend, enemy, stranger. The second one, the categories are me and others. And the others could be friends, enemies, strangers, but it's, yeah, that's right. To say there's no difference between me and everyone else. The first one is just friends, enemies, and strangers. You don't have to be there, right? You can just look around and go, gee, these people behave friendly, these people behave like this, these are like this. They're the other. You're looking at them and going, okay, but they don't stay in their categories, do they? They shift about. Yeah, that's right. No, that's right. Yeah. Yep. I think you were, but what's the primary relationship here? The second one is self and others. The first one is friend, enemy, stranger. And what are you trying to do there is to remove the bias of attachment towards friends, aversion towards the enemy, and indifference toward the stranger. Right? Here, it's between you and I, and what are we trying to recognize there? I want to be happy, you want to be happy. You don't want to suffer, I don't want to suffer. So there's your, in a nutshell, your categories and the types of thinking. Is that okay? Is that like, just get that? Two types, friend, enemy, stranger. What's the idea? Remove the bias, remove attachment, aversion, indifference. Over here, you and I. What are we doing there? We're the same. Why? You want to be happy. I do. You don't like to suffer. Neither do I. And yet we're both, you know, both of us are not happy and we're both suffering. That's the third little part you can add. We're the same. So we see sameness there. And we look at the sameness when you can, you know, like I said, if you just took, we know that, right, strangers don't say strangers to everybody like forever. Neither do enemies, neither do helpful people. They swap over all the time. So to think that they are just, they are that category, we're wrong. That's what it's trying to get at. So don't hold too tightly, in other words, to their behavior at that time. So another example, I'll give you a quick one. So many years ago, it was way before I became a Dharma student, I had a really good friend, and his wife treated him badly one day. And I was around the house at that time, and I saw her behavior, and I went, in my own mind, you're off. So in New Zealand, we call this off tap, meaning a bad person. First of all, you don't want to have anything to do with. And for me, that means you don't talk to them, you don't mess around, you don't have nothing to do with them. They're like poison. And that's what it is. That behavior, I don't want to know a person like you. So that's what I did for nearly 20 years. And my mate said to me one day, look, I've noticed, blah, blah, blah. You don't argue against my wife. And I go, no, I won't do it. Why not? He says, well, first of all, John, she's your wife. And then I told him what I'd witnessed 20-odd years ago. Next time I was over there, John wasn't there, and his wife said to me, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't, John's told her. So she said, yes, that day that you came over, she had a terrible day, really bad day, and it all came out while I was there. And then, of course, they were married for all that time, next 20 years. Right? So I'm thinking and going like, oh, my God, of course, people have bad days. It doesn't mean they're bad people, right? Which is the category I stuck them in, right? The bad person. This is not a bad thing. It was okay. And I go, oh, my God. So I thought, geez, that was a big mistake. I can't allow myself to think like that anymore, because I often do. I used to. That would be it. I'd categorize people, decide whether you're in my in-group or else you're out. That's it. But when she said, I just had a bad day, I go, oh, my gosh, everybody has bad days, right? Imagine in that, if I was put in the category just because I had a bad day.
What about really bad people?
This is interesting, right? So this was going to, I don't want to say this to you today, but I found it just recently that nowhere in the text does it say there are bad people. There is bad behaviors by people. That's true. Unskillful, hurtful behaviors by people. But there are no bad people. I mean, we use the term, call them bad people. That's true. And it's a convention that we all understand. Yeah, they behave badly, but they're not intrinsically really bad. It's like, you might say, well, Hitler was a bad person. Right? And then you go, his dog loved him. His dog loved him. Yeah. So how can a bad person be loved? Shouldn't be, if they're bad. So you say, so again, it's not as certain and stable as it seems to be. But people who behave badly, we call them bad people. And then we think, then what happens is that we equate their behavior with the person, but people aren't their behavior. Yeah, to disentangle. One of the things that often happens, I've just forgotten the term, but someone might remember it. So when Corey Jackson was here talking about this, when you get a term and you put it on something and then there seems to be one and the same thing. Fusion. What's it called? And what's it called? Something fusion. Cognitive fusion. So I'm forgetting all the stuff. Right? So cognitive fusion is when your ideas about something appear to be the thing itself. This is a really great way to screw yourself up thinking, because this is what people do, oftentimes thinking in bed all on their own, and they think their thoughts are true. They think their thoughts are relating to the actual thing. But they're not. So it's the same sort of thing with, in other words, the label and what they've put it on are what is seen as to be one and the same. But in fact, there's two phenomena there, isn't it? There's the person, and there's the behavior, and there's the label on each. But so they're not the same, but thinking they're the same, yeah. And we speak of them as they are the same and that, but they're actually not. And I would suggest the same for you guys too. If you're in a relationship and your wife or your husband or your kids are behaving really badly, the concern really should be like, that's suffering right there. It has to be stopped, because if you don't stop it, they're going to suffer more. Every time that stuff goes on, who suffers most, or for sure, is the person who's distressed. Right? They're in the throes of suffering, and guess what? They're creating some more. It's terrible. A terrible thing. So if we can sort of stop it in some way and not do it ourselves, of course, try, it'll take time, of course. But we have to try. I just think it's so like unnecessary. I would think I'll have to ask Cal to keep quiet next class. Say it again, please, Cal. So Cal was saying, if you believe bad people, then there's punishment. But if you believe bad behavior, then there's a sense of rehabilitation and so forth. Yeah. And so some of you might have, you know, on television, it happens a lot. But it also happens a lot. Well, I see it on television. In America, you know, you've got these court cases, especially against really serious bad crimes, right? So what does the prosecution try and do? Always try to convince the jurors and everybody on that we're dealing with a monster. This is not a human. This is a monster. Real bad one. And, you know, we need to be serious. And we've got to basically hurt this monster. Stop him. That's the sort of take. Anyway, going a few. This will be our last meditation and then we'll call it quits. So, again, you just need to adjust your posture. Try to make sure your back is straight, shoulders relaxed. Slowly take a few minutes. Let your body breathe itself. Again, create an altruistic intention. We're going to, again, just look at equanimity. So what does equanimity look like when it supports the six causes and one effect meditation? In other words, what are we trying to do there? We're trying to remove the bias that arises from having attachment towards friends, aversion towards enemies, and indifference towards strangers. And what is equanimity when it supports the equalizing and exchanging self with others meditation? Well, here you see yourself and others as the same in having a wish for happiness and freedom from suffering. These two types of equanimity are like the careful leveling of two terraces on one hill. The lower terrace holds the still water of compassion for all beings as mothers. And the upper terrace lets that water flow without preference between the field called self and the field called others. So we try to rest now in an equanimity that does not favor one person over another and sees no difference between yourself and others. Perhaps next time you watch a football match or a sports event on television or at the game, see if you can do that. To rest in an equanimity that does not favour one person over another. And sees no difference between yourself and everyone surrounding you. And now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and just let it go. Okay, so I've come to the end of our class. So we've basically answered five questions related to equanimity in here. Do you know there are three types of equanimity? We start off with feeling, then there was the equanimity of application and meditation, and then immeasurable equanimity. And you know the difference between equanimity and indifference? And there's differences between six causes and equalizing, exchanging. So next week, so between now and then, if you can, just try and find anything on equanimity. There's a lot of it, but try and read stuff by His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Dalai Lama is really, really clear. That's what I like about them. Lama Zopa Rinpoche is really experiential, really heartfelt, and he's, the founder of this organization. If you can, give a go at memorizing that verse by Jigme Lingpa, because it tells you exactly what it is. And finally, next week we'll look at the six causes and one effect meditation. So in this meditation is the final thing. Where the equalize, sorry, the friend, enemy, stranger is a preliminary to the six causes and one effect meditation. The equanimity they develop there is the first step in six causes, one effect meditation is all beings have been my mother equally. But so there's a new form of equality coming in here based on the first one. I hope you're interested enough to come along and I can take you through it and it won't be too difficult to understand. So now we come to the closing. So let's, we've all spent time here thinking, talking, generating energy. Let's send that energy towards the goal that we're aspiring to, full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. And now this one describes the development of the mind of enlightenment. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, rise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. So this prayer summarizes that whole book, The Way of the Bodhisattva. Now prayers for His Holiness's long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, the prayer for the recognition of Rinpoche's reincarnation and quick finding of it. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable guru, to you, I make this request. Okay, that's the end of our class for today. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, sir.